you look suckish. You gotta make a bruise, they know your name now. You try to keep you cool. Good evening and welcome to Amandla, your 1 hour of African current affairs and analysis brought to you here at CKUT in Montreal. You can also listen to us online at ckut.ca, and I am sitting remotely from Doug in our respective living rooms. Doug, you've been a trooper in putting together the show this week, so please let our listeners know what's in store.
Well, I have a few political things that I'm really passionate about, and they seem to come together this weekend, in fact, because of course there was the soccer game between CF Montreal and Atlanta, and we won. but really it was May Day on Sunday, and it was a beautiful day for it, and the people came out in great numbers. And for me, May Day is an international day of solidarity for workers around the world. So I was there, and we'll talk a little bit about how that connects to Africa and so on after. Then I've also got a piece about, I wanted to check out how May Day was being celebrated in Africa. And there was quite some excitement in South Africa. President Ramaphosa, Cyril Ramaphosa, got booed off the stage at a COSATU May Day rally. And COSATU couldn't get the workers to go in the stadium. And when they finally did go in, they booed him off the stage. So it was quite an interesting experience. And the commentary from Ibrahim Harvey of South Africa, who's an old trade unionist and a good solid lefty. And then one of the focuses of the parade, given to the parade rather, by the Council of Canadians is end vaccine apartheid. And they put out pamphlets to be distributed by across Canada at May Day celebrations. And so I distributed my 40 at the parade on Sunday. And I sent a note to Nicholas Barry Shaw, who is the campaign trade and privatization campaigner at the Council for Canadians. And he asked that I give feedback, or people who distributed give feedback. I gave it to him, and he said, "Oh, were you at the parade? I was there too. Let's talk about it." So he's going to be interviewed and tell us all about their angle on it, and also why Moderna installing a pharmaceutical plant to do COVID and other vaccines here in Montreal is not really all that positive a move. And finally, a little quick book review or a report review: Financialization of Malaria, Burkina Faso, Rogue Capital, and Genetically Modified Mosquitoes. This is put out by the African Center for Biodiversity, a must read for all Africanists. So stay tuned to Amandla. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Amanda here on CKUT 90.3 FM, online at ckut.ca. And Doug, tell us what we were just listening to.
Well, that was the May Day parade, the centerpiece, and because they walk actually about in the center of the plate was about an 8-person or 9-person drum ensemble called Cumpania. And they are amazing, and they can really bring the crowd to its feet and keep it motivated. And their drumming, especially the bass drums walking down St. Catharines, was just reverberating off the walls and echoing very, very cool, you know. And at the end, they did about a 10-minute presentation, or just a comedy act almost, of their drumming. It was a really cool mix of Brazilian and Cuban African, and it was fun. And they almost started a strip. They were throwing off their shoes and their coats and their hats and the center of it, and ended up with a big flare.
And the other, it sounds like it was, go ahead.
Well, the other sound pit you heard was the group of women that we were walking with. There were a large number of immigrant women workers in the middle of the parade, right behind the unions, but before the political groups. And they were really well represented. Well, there was the Immigrant Workers Center, and one of their reps gave a long discourse about the forgotten work, the guardian angels, and how they've been forgotten by government and all of that. She was very, very eloquent. And there were a large number of Filipina and Latina women, and from different organizations, from Colombia, from Philippines, of course. And so there was a one cheerleader woman there with a little microphone that led that stuff, and boy did she ever keep them going. And there were about 4 or 5 cheers that she had done. So it was a fun day.
Well, it sounds like it was a very galvanizing day too. So tell us a little bit about maybe some of the key issues that were addressed, in particular how they would relate back to Africa.
Well,
just to remind our listeners, we're talking about the May Day celebrations that last weekend
here in Montreal. Yes. Well, how do they relate to Africa? Well, amongst the other things is the very issue I mentioned of the ghost workers. Many of those are African immigrants, refugee applicants, or people here on unusual circumstances, permits. And they were recruited quite gladly into the healthcare system early on, and have been extensively exploited and put at great risk of their lives, even as that COVID epidemic hit the various nursing homes and hospitals and residences that they were working in. So that's one, because there are people they're here in the diaspora. And the other is, of course, the end vaccine campaign that the Council of Canadians wanted us to promote. And finally, of course, May Day is celebrated.
The end vaccine apartheid campaign.
End vaccine apartheid. What did I say?
Just to be clear, end vaccine campaign.
Apartheid campaign.
Just getting the letters now.
Yep. End vaccines. No. Wrong parade. Wrong convoy. Yeah.
Yes.
but also May Day is celebrated in Africa. I know in Zambia, countries like Zambia and Zimbabwe, it's actually a national holiday, and there's officially organized parades with the trade unions and all that. And in South Africa, it has been celebrated ever since. But things have not been going good in the tripartite grouping. Oh, yeah. And I will examine that more thoroughly in this next few minutes as we hear how COSATU organized its May Day rally.
This is the Congress of South African Trade Unions.
Exactly. And they invited the president, Cyril Ramaphosa, himself a former trade union member and leader of COSATU at one time. Well, no, the mine workers. And they invited him to address the workers because there was a big strike going on in one of the local mines near Rustenburg where they were holding this. And first, the workers refused to go into the stadium. The COSATU couldn't fill the stadium. There was, the stands were empty.
Finally, because the president was invited?
There's such antipathy from local union members to their union structures being so collaborative with the nastiness of the ANC regime. And so the antipathy manifests itself by, you guys are not telling us what to do. You don't support us in our local strike. So when the local strikers, two different groups, decided to go in, it was to berate the president, and he never managed to get a word in edgewise. They literally booed him off the stage, and then when they started pressing too hard, emphatically against the security detail, the president was whisked away. So I've got an analysis of that. At first, I've got some clips that describe it and feedback from workers. And then I've got an analysis by Abraham Harvey, himself an elder in the trade union and communist movement, to bring us up to date on that.
Okay. It never rains but pours for the tripartite alliance.
Okay, that's fine.
36-year Workers' Day celebrations by COSATU descended into chaos from the delays to the president being chased away from the main celebrations. The ANC president was said to give a supporting message from his party. Workers here say they're tired of empty promises.
For more than 4 years, we have not been getting the increment. The resolution of 2018 is very clear on public servants getting the increment. In fact, SATU, Nehau, and all the public servants went to sell us out and give us a 1.5 increment, but that is nothing.
I've been working under contract since 2004. Since now, I'm working under contract. I fix the wall, I do all the work, I attended the classes, but nothing has ever happened. That we must be
looks like they have for their shares in the contractors. Why? That's why the contractors doesn't give us enough money that we are working. And then us as the contractors, it's us that we're working hard, and then we're working in the spaces that is too much dangerous.
On his arrival, the ANC president was met by some hostile workers, somewhere from the Sibanye Stillwater mine, saying government failed to intervene in their plight. The official program had to be stopped so the president could address the angry workers. But that wasn't all. Another group came also to register its grievances. But their message was clear. They wanted the ANC president to leave and not address the rally.
This is your day. This is your day.
The ANC president called for calm, but his message fell on deaf ears.
Okay, Kurupi. Listen there. Mamela. Members of COSATU. Members of AMCU, Mamelang, you want your 1,000 rand. I get what you want. You want your 1,000 rand. I understand that. You want the employers to give you 1,000 rand. We've heard that message.
Meanwhile, both COSATU and the ANC said the issues of differences between workers and the ANC-led government will be discussed at the Alliance Political Council. Ntlandla Khatlani, SABC News, in Rustenburg.
In case you just joined us, let's recap the big event that happened today. The ANC president, Cyril Ramaphosa, was unable to deliver his message at COSATU's main Workers' Day rally, after angry mine workers disrupted the event. They wanted him to intervene in their ongoing wage strike at Sibanye. For more on this, I'm joined now by Ibrahim Harvey, a former trade unionist, who will speak to me about today's developments. Dr. Harvey, good evening. Thank you for your time. So, I don't know, I'm still undecided as to whether what we witnessed today will prove to be of any historical significance, at least politically, or was it just a blip that can be, you know, that the ANC president can ride out and hold together the semblance of an alliance that remains. What's your sense of what we witnessed today?
No, you know, we shouldn't be naive about what has happened today. What you've indicated, with all due respect, you know, is that, you know, this is deeply symptomatic of the fact of the worst ever crisis in the ruling alliance of the ANC, COSATU, and the SACP. which I've been writing about for over two decades, asking COSATU, what are they doing that allowing the suckers for punishment at the receiving end of so much abuse, etc., and they're still there. So but now it's far worse. The alliance now is riddled with the kind of contradictions and contrasts and problems that even when I wrote two decades ago was mild in comparison. So there is no doubt they've got serious problems, NUM and AMCU at Sibanye, with the wage negotiations. So I think you need to answer your question, you need to look at what has happened to the ruling alliance over the past few years. And don't forget that Labour is extremely unhappy with the ANC. You can see what happened in the public sector when the ANC government reneged last year on a three-year public sector formal wage agreement. They are terribly unhappy. Let me tell you, there are many other things that are going wrong, but that thing has been a very sore point with the public sector unions in particular. So there's a lot more that I could add to this to indicate how serious. In fact, the seriousness in the COSATU alliance, I mean, the ANC alliance in government is unprecedented. And in COSATU itself, you know, after the split that occurred in COSATU 2015, Vavi went off and formed SAFTU. SAFTU is having serious problems of its own. And the Socialist Workers' Revolutionary Party that's born out of SAFTU, they never even participated in last year's elections. So poor was their performance in the previous elections. But on the whole, let no one else tell you anything else. The trade union and broader labor movement is in the worst crisis for a number of reasons, both in South Africa and globally. That is sure. You know, there are parts to May Day. You got to recall the deeper history, and then you got to recall contemporary struggles. You know, Cyril was prevented from speaking because people were angry, but I wonder what he would have said, you know, if he really delivered that speech and what it would have consisted of. Because, you know, in fact, the crisis in the in COSATU itself and the split, I don't want to use this opportunity to go into it now.
Sure.
But the ANC and SACP, I'm telling you now in public, were responsible partly for that split in COSATU, you know. So there are lots things to be said, but I mean, you know, Reuel Bafokeng, before something, before appraising the fact that he never spoke and why, look at the attendance. You know, when I was in Sotu, there were 20, 30, 40,000 people at rallies when you, you know, celebrated May Day. Mm. I think there was 1,000 around there, you know. I think the people they were so embarrassed by the attendance, you know. But very important, if you go back to the clips, and Nehao's shop steward spoke before Ramaphosa was supposed to speak, and hear what he has to say about how seriously Nehao was unhappy with the ANC. Nehao was one of the unions that was, you know, full force behind the ANC. They never went with Vavi and formed SAFTU. They stuck in COSATU, and they're the most unhappiest union in COSATU, primarily because
Dr. Harvey, to what extent is this crisis that you describe accounted for by a feeling of one, helplessness by the workers, that, you know, their voices are just simply, their political voice just doesn't hold sway within the governing alliance led by the ANC, or two, at a personality level, that, you know, they had invested some hope and what they hoped would be political capital in the personality of the president, who was, after all, a founder member of the National Union of Mine Workers, pivotal in the mass democratic movement, but also former secretary general of the ANC, and someone that they catapulted to the echelons of leadership in the ANC.
No, it's a combination, Tulas. The answer to that lies the combination of reasons and factors. There's no doubt, you know, that the COSATU still continues to be largely electoral cannon fodder for the ANC at election time, something I said when I had a column with the Mail and Guardian over two decades. It's still the same thing. In fact, it's worse off now because, you know, there's massive retrenchments that's going on in the public sector and the private sector at the moment. The unprecedented rise in the cost of living, etc. So there is a combination of reasons. And you know what is very significant is that the Royal Bafokeng and Rustenburg region is very strong, you know, with the mining trade unions, you know. And just look how unhappy are people that such a poor turnout on Labor Day is very significant, I think, with deep-seated disenchantment with the ANC. And particularly, you know, one has to face these facts, really. Even regarding the Eskom crisis, you know, Zuma placed Ramaphosa in charge of Eskom in 2014. Nobody goes there. But certainly, they are deeply disappointed, and the president of COSATU has expressed it on numerous occasions. They, NUM, and then they rallied COSATU to get the support for Cyril for 2017. They certainly, without the support of COSATU, I don't think he would have made it, because COSATU brought in the SACP to support him. They are deeply disappointed. I think Cyril is caught up in a lot of contradictions and problems within the ANC, and he's got to keep watch his back because of the other faction in the ANC, you know, that's targeting him, that, you know, would hope that he loses in the election, the ANC's national conference in December. So I think there's a whole lot of challenges that Cyril faces, you know, but there's no doubt they're disappointed in COSATU with his performance since 2008. The electoral conference, you know, of 2017 when he was elected.
Lastly, Dr. Harvey, lastly, to what extent could this moment signal workers on the shop floor trying to wrest back control of the labor movement, in the sense that, you know, one of the features that stood out for me was that I don't know what President Ramaphosa of the ANC was going to say once he took to that podium, but I do suspect that much of it would have been political speak, a global view of the state of the alliance and other issues at a much higher level along the lines of what Zingi Swalosi had been doing. Not saying that they're not touching on workers' issues, they are, but it seems to me that these workers were quite specific in saying that we want 1,000 rand to be, you know, to be granted by this company, Sibanye, which talks to the material conditions that they face, which seems to have been a feature even during the Marikana strikes and the Platinum Belt strikes that we saw subsequent to Marikana. To what extent then does this moment signify that at least portions of the labor movement want to wrest back control, to say let's focus on the shop floor issues and stop this pandering to the political whims of the leader of the alliance in the form of the ANC and playing in the affectional spaces?
No, look, these material conditions and the struggles around it, whether wages and other working conditions, the working class is always involved with that, whether there's organization or not organization, or there are kind of serious problems that we've had, you know, in South Africa. Workers have always been in it. If you look at it, the number of strikes that have taken place in the past few years, you would think that, you know, there's an indication of the need to organize, but you know, the percentage of workers that are organized in South Africa is 25-26%, still very low. But there's no doubt, and don't forget, you have to interrogate, besides the political problems with the ANC leave, look what has happened in the trade union movement itself. The massive corruption as a result of the investment wings of the trade unions. I mean, you know, just recently you've seen what they had to say about NUMSA's investment wing and the problems there. One of the biggest reasons, nobody goes into it, the reason why workers have become distrustful of trade unions is primarily a lot of real factors, but what has happened with the investment wings and how workers' monies and funds have been stolen by the leadership of these investment companies, we don't go into. And I can tell you there's a lot of contributing factors to. It's a sad day, and let nobody tell you, you know, May Day is not just to recall the important, you know, glorious moments of the history, but also contemporary struggles. And there's little to be celebrated of, really, if you talk about what workers are facing, and especially how the ANC has treated COSATU and the broader working class for an organization that says it's pro-poor policies. I mean, it's just an absolute, you know, amazing thing what has happened. The ANC is the biggest problem, to my mind, of what the labor movement has faced since 1994. And certainly, if you look at the ruling alliance, the problems that COSATU in particular, less the SACP, the SACP seems to have gone along mostly with the ANC, but the COSATU has been a big thorn in the side of the ANC, I think, you know, which is in fact why NUMSA split the last time. They had enough of being electoral cannon fodder for the ANC. That's why they broke. They said they've had enough of it. Mm. Whether the rest of COSATU, in the light of what's going on, you know, will decide, you know, there's talks already that COSATU has approached NUMSA, which is the biggest affiliate of SAFTU, for unity talks. So there's, I'm hoping. You see, you can't talk about tackling the ANC and government and neoliberalism if you don't have unity of workers. The unity of workers is essential, and I'm hoping that, you know, SAFTU and COSATU get together, you know, and reunite, and then thereafter seek a broader unity involving, trade union federations, you know, like NAFTU and so on.
All right, I've got to thank you for your time and your insights, your sharp insights there, Dr. Ibrahim Harvey, a former trade unionist and a veteran political analyst and political writer there, weighing in on the events that we saw earlier on at the Royal Bafokeng Stadium in Rustenburg, where President Cyril Ramaphosa, in his capacity as ANC president, was unable to address the May Day rally organized by COSATU.
Yes, well, that was what happened in South Africa on May Day. But the other thing about May Day that got me really interested was the campaign to end vaccine apartheid that the Council of Canadians had initiated to piggyback with the May Day rallies. And they sent us pamphlets that we were encouraged to hand out. And so I went to the May Day rally. And as listeners at this station will know, we here at Amandla have been very, very concerned about the injustice of the since the coronavirus began. Interviewing early on in 2020, probably May of 2020, Dr. Kravin Salim, a major epidemiologist from South Africa, who made it very clear in his interview that the global response to the COVID pandemic will never end, and made reference to the HIV/AIDS never end unless it's global. That's what he was making the point of. And he made very close reference to the HIV/AIDS experience and how similar forces were at work in condemning African HIV victims to inevitable death when medicines were adequate medical response was refused. So the Council of Canadians are actually picking up on that kind of and the concept of vaccine apartheid has come about. So I wrote to Nicholas Barry Shaw, who's the trade and privatization campaigner at the Council of Canadians, and he came back very quickly to say, oh yeah, let's talk about this. And so Nicholas, welcome to Amandla.
Thanks, Doug. Thanks for having me on.
Well, Nicholas, could you just tell us this whole initiative that the council has come up with to end vaccine apartheid? I'm not quite on top of it right now, so it would be good for all of us to catch up on it.
Yeah, well, I mean, the campaign at its base is a demand that the Canadian government, support the call for a TRIPS waiver, so a lifting of patents on vaccines and other, essential medicines that are needed to fight the pandemic. And this is a call that was raised by South Africa and India at the World Trade Organization back in October of 2020. So it's been almost a year and a half now that the measure has been put forward. It's now supported by over 100 countries at the World Trade Organization. But there's a handful of holdouts that are very close to the pharmaceutical industry that continue to block this measure. And Canada, unfortunately, is one of them. And so what we've been, mobilizing around since September, especially, we really ramped things up. We've been calling on people to meet with their MPs. We've been calling on people to write letters to their MPs. And for May 1st, we called on people, in collaboration with the Trade Justice Network, to go out to the May Day rallies, to raise awareness about this issue, distribute leaflets, and encourage people to join this fight, which I think is very appropriate to raise on International Workers' Day, when international solidarity should really be on the agenda for everybody.
Absolutely, and a very honorable campaign. I participated in my little way by distributing flyers, and the other thing you have them doing is getting in touch with their MPs. I did that, and I got my standard letter back from our local MP here in Saint-Laurent. The film as well. Did you watch it? Have you seen it through yet? And the film by Rehad Desai.
Yes, I have.
And yeah. I highly recommend it. It's available, definitely. And it's on Al Jazeera in full, and highly recommend it. And in fact, I'm going to play an interview that the South African Broadcasting Corporation did with him after to reinforce his side of that whole thing. The other thing that you brought up out of this vaccine apartheid situation was a press release, and you think your name was on it, that denounced the fact that Moderna was being encouraged to set up another factory to produce vaccines here in Quebec. What can you go over the elements of all that for us, please?
It was announced early last week. I believe it was Wednesday that the government kind of leaked to the media that they would be announcing the arrival of a Moderna vaccine producing factory in Montreal. And so they had this press conference at McGill University, kind of with Trudeau and Legault, and the CEO of Moderna, Stéphane Bancel, were there. And, they were presenting this as a win. Canada's going to have vaccine producing capacities, and this wonderful. But for the council, and I think for anyone who's concerned with vaccine equity, I mean, it's just a symptom of Canada's capitulation to these companies. We are going to be giving probably millions, they haven't released the amount, but millions likely in subsidies for Moderna to come to Montreal. And we still haven't supported the lifting of patents, and we haven't supported the sharing of the technology with other places. And so I think this is really entrenching this model where, you have a handful of global pharmaceutical companies who have a monopoly on these life-saving medicines, on vaccines and therapeutics and so on. And, they've made stupendous profits. Bancel is a billionaire, CEO of Moderna. He was worth $12 billion at one point. I think it's come down a bit because the stock has fluctuated. But there's about three or four people in the ranks of Moderna's investors and executives who are now billionaires just because of this vaccine that they've produced. And, they were one of the key architects of the inequality in access to vaccines that we've seen in the world since the beginning of the pandemic. They sold, I think, upwards of 90% of their vaccines to countries in the, in the more wealthier half of the world, and virtually nothing to lower income countries, concentrated overwhelmingly in Africa.
And quite the opposite. They collaborated very actively to sabotage Asian availability. And if even when it was being possible to get it out there. They had no interest in that.
This is another thing that, is another reason why the debates at the World Trade Organization ongoing right now about lifting the patents are so important, is because companies like Moderna have said for a long time, well, you know, mRNA technology, it's so complex, only we could possibly produce these highly technologically advanced vaccines. Well, lo and behold, a lab supported by the WHO in South Africa has reverse engineered the vaccine in Moderna's vaccine in record time. And how did Moderna respond to that?
Oh, they
immediately went to the patent office in South Africa and they filed patents. They say, oh, don't worry, we won't enforce them so long as the pandemic is ongoing. But they haven't said, you know, who will determine when the pandemic ends. And, they've still filed for those patents. So, you know, this kind of underlines the real importance of this measure of having a TRIPS waiver, because it'll protect these initiatives that are ongoing, like the WHO technology hub that has reverse engineered this vaccine. You know, otherwise it's going to be a situation where these companies continue to hold the monopoly and continue to sell to the highest bidder.
And it is very easily possible around the world to produce it. And in fact, there were Canadian pharmaceutical companies ready to produce generics at much, much cheaper prices. But they too are being forbid by the very same thing. And the parallels with HIV/AIDS are extraordinary. I mean, it goes back to the 90s when all those drugs were being held up and millions of people in Africa died. It was just outrageous apartheid at that point. I'm wondering how you feel this is going to turn, because for us that are so concerned about Africa, this is a very, very serious problem. And much of the spillover has come to Africa in other ways as well, with the vaccine hesitation when it is available, with the rumor mongering and the misinformation and disinformation. Where do you see all this going, Nicholas?
I think as far as vaccine hesitancy goes, I mean, I think it's true in Africa probably, and it's also true here in Canada, that a lot of people have looked at these vaccines, said, oh wow, they're developed so quickly, these companies are making such huge profits, there must be something going on, you know. And so the fact that we've put so much of our response to the pandemic in the hands of these corporations that nobody trusts, you know, it's not surprising that there are a lot of people out there who are hesitant or who have questions and are worried about getting vaccinated. And I think lifting the patents and allowing other companies to produce generic versions of these vaccines could be a way of relieving some of the fear or the concern that people have about these products. I think longer term within Canada and in other places, we need to look at really taking back control of the production of essential medicines like vaccines back into public hands, because having the private sector dominate this, having all the secrecy and often the dishonesty that they bring to the work, it really doesn't inspire trust for anyone. And, you know, we've seen in this pandemic, it's been really dramatic, that they will place their profits ahead of human lives every chance they get. And it really has to end. And it's hurting Canadians, it's hurting people in Africa. So I think we really need to look at investing in public manufacturing of drugs and public control of the research that goes into them.
Do you see any connection to the reluctance to institute a national, Canadian national pharmaceutical plan? In a similar light, that they're probably working against it because it would work against their interests in the long term?
There is a really close connection there. There was an excellent article by Justin Ling that appeared in Maclean's shortly before the elections in September. And maybe this is why it got overlooked, because there was probably so much election news that people didn't read it. But he quoted a government official who was working on this file. The government has been promising for couple of years now that they would regulate brand name drug prices. And so he spoke to one of the government insiders who was responsible for this initiative. And, you know, he said, well, the pharmaceutical companies basically have us over a barrel. And, you know, they're using their control over the vaccines to extract concessions from Canada. And I'm sure Canada is not the only country that has been put in this position. where the pharmaceuticals have used their power over the supply of vaccines and other drugs to really extract concessions. And you know, one of those concessions was rolling back the reductions in brand name drug prices that had been slated to come into effect. And so they delayed these regulations, I think 4 or 5 times. And then just recently, about a week ago, the government announced that they were going to cancel most of the reforms because, you know, the situation had changed and we don't need that. And so they basically handed back approximately $8 billion a year back to these companies. So they'll be able to continue to keep their prices high and, you know, it'll make any kind of national drug plan like PharmaCare, you know, that much more expensive. And it'll continue to draw resources from the public healthcare system. So
and from the other countries in the world that are not as well endowed with resources, it's just criminal. I guess what I can ask you to do is just give us a couple of email addresses or website and go through your list of campaign issues that you'd like us to get involved in. So let the listeners hear once more.
Sure. Yeah, I would encourage people to go to the website of the Council of Canadians, canadians.org, and you'll find there lots of articles and information on this, this campaign for vaccine justice. We have a webpage where people can send a letter to their MP. And so
I use it, and it's very easy. It's very, very convenient.
That's right. It'll just based on your postal code, it'll find who your MP is. So you don't have to do that research.
And then yourself. The letter pops up and you.
That's it. You know, and if people want to do more, we're encouraging our members and people who have sent letters to their MP to also request meetings, whether in person or virtual, with their MPs about this issue, because, you know, sending letters is good, but requesting a meeting is even better. It really shows the members of parliament that their constituents care about this issue, and they know that people will be talking about it. So, you know, we're there to support people who decide to take that step. We're giving talking points and things like that, and a bit of training to prepare people for those meetings. So we're trying to build basically a people's lobby against the really powerful big pharma lobby that has so far you know, controlled Canada's policy at the World Trade Organization and in many other aspects.
And one of the items I got, and this is a segue to the next piece I'm going to play on the radio, is that we should encourage people to watch the documentary Time of Pandemics by the South African filmmaker Rahad Desai. The whole film is available at Al Jazeera. Just go into Al Jazeera and search Time of Pandemics. It pops right up. The full film is about 45 minutes and very, very well done. And it compares HIV AIDS campaigning and problems of the past with the current dilemmas that we're now seeing. And what I'm going to be playing right after is an interview that he did with South African Broadcasting Corporation. So Nicholas Barry-Shaw, trade and privatization campaigner at the Council of Canadians, thank you very, very much for your solidarity. And we will try to contribute, as we hope you are going to continue, to try and make this campaign as effective as the ACT UP kind of campaign that got some action around HIV/AIDS. So thank you again.
Thank you, Doug.
Good night.
She walked very hard to get money, walk. She walked very hard to get money, walk. Need a bikini, rimbo, rebende. money, money, walk, walk, walk. She walk very high. She get money, money, walk, walk, walk. She walk very high. She get money, money, walk, walk, walk.
Rehad Desai joins us now to discuss his new film and what it meant to reflect on the journey. Rehad, very good morning to you. Thank you so much for joining us. I mean, the timing of us discussing this documentary is rather imperative because as we look back, we're now well into the fourth wave of a new variant, the third variant of its kind. And a lot of the questions that sort of came about when the COVID-19 outbreak first broke out are still relevant today. Like, as we ask questions about the Omicron variant, where does it come from? And as we look to your documentary, that trailer, we're also really trying to get some answers and some clarity. Talk to us about this film.
Yeah, well, it began its life following a vaccine trial, and I think that's going to be successful. The proof of concept is there that we can develop a vaccine for HIV. But really, when we look at the response to HIV, South Africa only got the drugs 8 years after they were available in Europe and America. And that meant the pandemic got out of control very quickly, the epidemic. And we now have over 9 million people HIV positive in South Africa alone. When you take the neighboring countries and sub-Saharan Africa, the HIV is very much centered. This global epidemic is very much centered in sub-Saharan Africa, and Southern Africa in particular. Now, that was a grave travesty, the fact that we had to lose so many people. We lost 10 million lives unnecessarily so, and we're beginning to see, I think, the prospect of losing those same amount of numbers with COVID. And the question is, what have we learned? What do we need to change? How do we get a system that is fit for purpose, a health system that can really take control of and contain these pandemics? And moreover, what do we need to begin to do to stop these pandemics, these zoonotic viruses like HIV and COVID coming thick and fast? We've seen Ebola, we've seen SARS-1, we've seen MERS, we've seen Zika. They're just coming very fast, and that is because of the big problem we have with deforestation and big agriculture, and I think we can do something about that. But the, I think what's most disturbing in Paul is that, you know, people who have immunosuppressed, you know, are immunosuppressed, have weak immune systems because they're not on HIV treatment, are particularly concerning. And Omicron is probably, you know, we look at this in the film, we don't shy away from this harsh reality. Omicron probably was developed in someone who was HIV positive some months back. It stayed in their system, if not earlier, and it evolved because they weren't able to get rid of it. Mm. Their system wasn't strong enough to recover. And that's what makes the world, you know, very vulnerable to these variants. So, you know, where HIV is endemic, we're going to see these HIV-positive people who are not on treatment becoming factories of variants, really producing variants at a very rapid speed inside their bodies. And I think it's pretty, most scientists are saying it's highly likely that, you know, if we can't get the world vaccinated quick enough, fast enough, mm-hmm. That these variants will continue to emerge, and one will emerge that escapes the ability of the vaccine to completely.
Rehad, in your documentary, sorry if you'll allow me to interrupt you, you essentially show that South Africa's public health resources are stretched beyond breaking point. I mean, you emphasize that quite a lot. We've just marked World AIDS Day a few days ago, and questions have really come to the forefront of the capability of South Africa to indeed achieve this ambitious target of reaching the zero HIV infections by the year 2030. I mean, it's a big question, especially looking at the healthcare system, further exacerbated by COVID-19.
Absolutely. So what we're seeing now is a situation where less people are on treatment than they were before COVID. Less people are coming for testing. The same with TB. We know those two diseases are interrelated too, that TB piggybacks on HIV. So the combination of these three are really devastating our health system. And unless we reprioritize our spending, and maybe that means increasing taxes or wealth tax or something to bolster our health service, in particular our antiretroviral program and our TB programs, and put in place a real test and trace system so we can begin, you know, when outbreaks emerge and variants emerge, we are able to attempt to contain them. But it's going to be a long, hard struggle, and we need international cooperation. We need those vaccines in neighboring countries in sub-Saharan Africa. 44 of the 66 countries that will be unable to meet their target of vaccinating 40% of their population, 44 of those 66 countries are in Africa. So something's got to give. The World Trade Organization is negotiating, has been negotiating this for 15 months. It's far too long. We need a quick resolve of this. But it's being blocked by those companies, those countries that have vaccine producers and whose pharmaceutical industries are strong and are producing these vaccines. So this economic interest, profits coming before lives, and I think this is a very worrying sign that these people know what's happening, but they continue to deny us the ability to produce these vaccines.
Absolutely.
To share the
Rehad, I'm going to have to ask us to leave it there for now. Something's definitely got to give. Rihad Desai, award-winning filmmaker at Uhuru Productions, speaking, of course, about his documentary, and, of course, a relevant one as we are in the face of a global pandemic, of course, also looking at the threats of the fourth wave.
The other item that caught my attention this week was a report from the African Center for Biodiversity, ACB. They published a new research paper titled "The Financialization of Malaria, Burkina Faso, Rogue Capital, and Genetically Mutated Mosquitoes." The paper seeks to understand the financialization of malaria as a vehicle for rogue capital in a context of a weakened state through capture, corruption, and coups, and the power that limits effective intervention. It shows how malaria, along with other diseases, is increasingly financialized through financial markets, institutions, actors, and motives that play a pivotal role in disease response. Country and donor funds are invested into research and development. Nonprofit organizations, for example, that partner with market actors such as pharmaceutical companies to bring the product to market. Patents are sought and royalties procured from the sale of the product to country governments. These royalties are then accumulated by the research and development company using vehicles such as endowment funds, for example. In this case, it shows how Burkina Faso is a real-world example of how rogue capital can enter a country and experiment with patented products with impunity and no fear of accountability. It also illustrates how both historical and modern factors create conducive conditions for philanthropic capitalists such as the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the companies they fund to exploit Africa as a living laboratory. The outcomes of risky experimental research such as genetically modified gene-driven mosquitoes is not yet known. What is known is that it is Africans who bear the consequences, not the owners of the technologies foisted on the continent. The paper is accompanied by three fact sheets, and you can get them all by going to the ACB website, to africanacbio.org.za. The papers are there, the whole report is there, and they demand that African citizens demand the decolonization of public health and propose sovereign solutions that will serve their priorities. We must demand that government direct funding to where it is really needed: the public health care system, sanitation, access to clean water, and improved housing. We must vehemently contest and ward off increased privatization of the health sector. Radical policy interventions are also reached that address historical disinvestments in health and enable recovery.
Well, thank you so much for that book review, Doug. And for those of you listeners who are interested in following up on this, actually, a couple of years ago, Zara Malou, who's a regular contributor here on Amandla and is also with the ETC group, produced a short film on the release of 200,000 genetically modified mosquitoes in Burkina Faso. So I would definitely encourage you to go and check that out. If you just Google Burkina Faso's mosquito controversy or GMO mosquitoes in Zara Malou, Zahra Malou, it will pop up. And she's done some great work around that. So I encourage you to check it out. So Doug, thank you so much. Amazing show. You've been listening to Amandla here on CQT 90.3 FM in Montreal. Stay tuned now for Jazz Euphoria.
Today's hottest artist, Carol G. Strip Love Tour. In concert. Saturday, September 17th at Bell Center. Get tickets now at carolgmusic.com. Carol G. Strip Love Tour.
You're knocking on the right door. If you're looking for something, well, refreshing, you're tuned in to the right station. You're listening to the coolest station in Montreal, 90.3 FM on your dial, the alternative station, the one that gives you a choice and a voice. CKUT, stay tuned.